Roosevelt Warm Springs Institute for Rehabilitation, Second Research Symposium on the Late Effects of Poliomyelitis. Tape number 10, session number 4.
The small angulated fibers, we feel that the small angulated fibers are common or characteristic in patients with new weakness. We do not see small angulated fibers in patients who had stable muscles. This is, we feel it's due to new denervation. As I mentioned earlier, we did not see group atrophy in those muscles that have been biopsied twice. This is the closest we have seen to group atrophy. These are sort of 4 or 5 muscle fibers, but not really severe group atrophy, as you see in a progressive disease like an ALS. So these patients here have, post-polio patients have small angulated fibers, but not group atrophy in the follow-up biopsies, which makes us believe that this the new weakness is not due to dropout of the whole motor neuron, but due to death of the distal sprouts, which confirmed the previous electrophysiological studies. Now, another finding that we noticed was inflammation. We found inflammation in up to 40% of the muscle biopsies. The inflammation was not severe, was mild, but it was there. This is another area of inflammation. These cells are lymphocytes. When we did the serial sections with alkaline phosphatase, there are very few of these cells were alkaline phosphatase positive, which suggests that they are not macrophages and they are not monocytes. We did also immunostochemical studies with monoclonal antibodies. These are OKT3 positive lymphocytes. And the spinal cord examination that Dr. Pez also saw before, I'm not going to go through. Just only to emphasize that there is new inflammation there, as Dr. Pez mentioned before, and active gliosis. And I would like, before we'll conclude, to show this slide that Dr. Albert Sabin gave me. This is a slide from a monkey who has recovered from paralytic poliomyelitis. This is 1 month after complete recovery. And you see active disease in the spinal cord. And just to summarize and put our thoughts there, what is going on in PPMA? Well, first, we believe that PPMA is due to death of individual nerve terminals, but not due to death of the whole motor unit. The motor unit in PPMA is very large, much larger than in asymptomatic post-polio. I forgot to mention before that when we looked at the muscle biopsies of asymptomatic post-polios, we saw grouping, but the number of fibers in these groups were much smaller than what in other muscles were. We believe that in post-polio, reinnervation continues via distal sprouting until enough new terminals are destroyed, enough reserves diminish, and further reinnervation cannot be supported. This appears to be an ongoing process. So what we really see in PPMA is the tip of the iceberg in a smoldering neuronal dysfunction that appears to continue since the original disease. So the tip of the iceberg basically represents the death of these small distal sprouts, which continues until you reach a limit and then you develop the new weakness. Thank you. I will stop here.
Jasper Dalby, Rochester, Minnesota. An elegant study, as we've all recognized since we saw it published in your new data that you've added now. In making the comparison between those patients who are progressing or those limbs that are progressing and those that are not, I think it's essential that there be matching of the severity of involvement of the muscle. In your biopsies or in your electrophysiologic studies, did you match so that the muscle that was asymptomatic, not progressing, was in fact equally severely involved?
No, we didn't do that. There's no doubt that this is a very essential control. I'm not sure if it will be possible to do that in a large number of patients, but I agree this is an important control.
Johnson, Columbus. Two questions. First, why did you drop the first P from what we decided 2 years ago to be PPPMA?
Well, too many P's.
Okay. The second question was really not too frivolous, but was it Dr. Sabin who gave you that slide?
Yes.
He said, I just wondered who did the manual muscle test on the monkeys to say they were normal.
It was a monkey's uncle.
Ernie, I say what he told me, so...
Munsat, Boston. Marinus, you've demonstrated so nicely inflammatory changes in muscle, immunoglobulin abnormalities in spinal fluid, inflammatory changes around the anterior horn cells at time of autopsy, and the electrophysiologic findings that we've heard of instability and reorganization of motor units. Most of the talk has been in terms of pathogenesis, but based on these observations, do you feel that these findings could be caused by the normal age-related alterations in the alpha motor neuron, or is it more likely that a virologic slash immunologic process is still active?
Ted, you raised two very important questions, and I don't think we have the answer. Overall, the aging process, at least in the motor neurons, we know from the elegant studies of Professor Tomlinson, who saw them last year, 2 years ago here, and from the studies that he has done with Tom Walton, the aging in the neurons starts after the age of 60. For this reason specifically, we selected to study patients who are below the age of 60. In the muscle biopsies that we did in a control study with the Institute of Aging, looking at the muscle changes in normal aging people, we found some angulated fibers and chronic denervation and some grouping in normal people above the age of 70. We have series of patients from 70 to 80. So some of these things I think are not due to aging. Now, why we have inflammation there? Why we have abnormal proteins in the CSF? We have inflammation in the muscle, inflammation in the spinal cord, and ongoing changes. What is going on? I really don't know if there is any if these are secondary phenomena to something. It's a reaction to something, or if there is an ongoing viral activity. To answer that question, we need two things. One is to do in situ hybridization in the spinal cord, which is in the process in the planning to do, to see if there are viral particles there. And the second is to identify the bands in the CSF to see if they represent antibodies to viral proteins. And we have been trying to do that. We have not been very, our techniques have not been that good have been inconclusive, actually. Now, the other issue is, if there is inflammation there, should we treat these patients with immunosuppressive agents? And again, I don't know the answer either. We have treated three patients, two with prednisone and cyclophosphamide, like polymyositis. In fact, one patient was Dr. Ben Brooks' patient, who told me who was following this patient before I was at the NIH, and the patient did not improve. The other patient was treated with interferon, and he did not improve. So I really don't know if what this inflammation means at the moment.
Dick Sprott from the Aging Institute, and I finally get a chance to make one comment to justify my existence here. Which I've been waiting for 2 days wondering if I would ever get to do. And that is, I think, the comment I'm going to make was implied by something Dr. DeLacca said, and that is that, just to remind you, I hope it's a reminder, that aging is not a disease. Aging may allow persons to be around long enough to express disease. And what we see in the aging patient may simply be the expression of other diseases. And I think that's been implied by things that a number of you said in the last 2 days, and just give me the chance to remind you.
Moses was 636 years.
Anna McComas, in relation to Dr. Munstead's question about aging, it is true, as Dr. Dalak has said, that whole motor units seem to function after the age of 60. This was Tomlinson's work and also the results of our motor unit counting work. However, if you measure muscle strength, as Tony van der Wert and I did recently and have just published in the Journal of Applied Physiology, it seems quite clear that in the ankle dorsiflexors and plantar flexors, that strength starts to fall off in the early 50s. The intersect of the two lines is about age 52, 53. So it may well be, as you imply, that there is a stage where individual nerve twigs stop functioning, and that this happens perhaps some years before the rest of the motor unit degenerates.
That's very interesting. I always had difficulty to, clinically at least, to define what is the normal strength in a 70-year-old person or 80-year-old person. I'm glad to hear that there are some studies going. Perhaps Dr. Munstead's quantitative studies in normal aging may give us... Yeah, I think we need this information Dr. McComas said, it's very important. Yeah.
I'd like to make a comment on the effects of Jacqueline Perry from California. I'd like to make a comment on the effects of aging on strength. We've looked at a group of normal elderly people averaging age 70. We looked at three muscle groups, the hip extensors, the quadriceps, and the hip abductors. And what we found was about a 50% loss of hip extensors and quadriceps compared to a normal group of average people at Rancho. But we found no loss in the hip abductors. This suggests to me that a lot of our recorded strength loss is decreased activity. And the faster you go, the more you use your quadriceps, the more you use your extensor system in the sagittal plane. But you still only lift your body weight with the abductors, and so their load has not changed.
A quick comment from Dr. Grimby.
Gunnar Grimby, Gothenburg. Just one more comment on aging. Comparing muscle changes between quadriceps and biceps in 70, 77, and around 80 years old, so-called clinical healthy men and women, there is quite a marked difference with less reduction in size of muscle fibers, especially type 2 fibers, in the upper extremity than in the lower extremity, indicating differences in activity pattern. And there are also quite a number of other muscles studied concerning strength, indicating different age changes, which probably to at least some extent is due to different activity pattern.
So the lower extremities are better preserved? Or
no, I said the opposite.
The opposite.
I said type 2 fibers larger in biceps than in vastus lateralis.
Okay. So the upper extremities are better preserved? Then.
At least biceps, yes.
Anyway, I think we better... Okay, we'll stop. I have you come back in 15 minutes. It'll be about 3:25. Thank you, Dr. Lakas. So that we can complete the afternoon session. Our next speaker is Dr. Gunnar Grimby from the University of Gothenburg, who's going to be talking on muscle morphology in post-polio patients.
I would like to thank Dr. Holstedt for calling Dr. Fugelmeier about 3 years ago, saying that studying polio patients in Sweden would be a good idea, and Dr. Fugelmeier calling me saying the same, and we have then in Göteborg performed studies in a number of
post-polio subjects. So that's how it got started. I also like to thank Dr. Holstedt at the same time for getting me the chance to present the data here. We would try first in Göteborg, Sweden, which is a city of about 500,000 inhabitants and its surrounding area, to find as many, and if possible naturally all, polio subjects with certain criteria which we were interested in. It appeared to be some difficulties to find as many as we wanted. The criteria for selection into this study was that I would have had polio more than 25 years ago. They should be born between 1920 and 1945, being of the age 40 to 65 years at the time of the study, and living in the Göteborg area for medical service, which is little more than just the city of Göteborg. We looked through the hospital records over those years, and we had contact with the Polio Association, and could in that way identify 156 persons, of which 68 persons fulfilled these criteria, and 41 of these 68 persons volunteered for the present study, which has more component than muscle biopsy and muscle function studies. Next slide shows the complete content of our study. Medical history and examination, social conditions with a quite number of questionnaires, ADL function using CATS index, and also some other questionnaires, classification according to WHO of handicap, respiratory function studies, vital capacity and respiratory pressure measurements, muscle strength measurements with manual testing, and measurement of the knee muscle strength with the Cybex equipment, isometric and isokinetically, muscle biopsy, and then at the end, in a small subsample, some electrophysiological studies. Now here today, we will report only results from this part, and my colleague Dr. Einarsson, who will come after this presentation, will report also only using this part of the study. The methods used for the presentation today were thus measurement of muscle strength using the Cybex dynamometer with measurement of isokinetic maximal voluntary isometric contractions at different angular velocity between 30 and 300 degrees per second, and measurement of isometric maximal voluntary contractions at two different knee angles, 30 and 60 degrees. Muscle biopsies performed with what we can call a semi-open technique using a conchotome and from vastus lateralis muscles. For determination of muscle fiber distribution using different pre-incubation and ATPase staining. Fiber area measurements using a technique we used in quite a number of years, where we can measure fiber area for usually around 300 to 500 muscle fibers of different types. Histopathological examination with different type of staining, and enzymatic analysis of oxidative and glycolytic enzymes after homogenization. In a group from the whole material where muscle strength was measured with the Cybex equipment, and here just presented as a overview of the reduction in muscle strength, and here are presented results from one of the legs, the leg which was most affected, if it was possible to produce a full knee extension with that leg, thus having at least score 3 in the MRC scale. So So it's just an example of findings, but I will then tell you why I show this example. Reduction in isometric and isokinetic measured muscle strength, here compared with two control materials from our own department, one of randomly selected 70-year-old healthy men and women, and one from a middle-aged group of healthy, also not randomly selected, men and women. And you can see that the reduction in strength from the control group of middle-aged persons was more than 50% for all these different types of measurements, and in about the same percentage for all these type of proportion for all these type of measurements. So there is a quite marked reduction in muscle strength in this group of subjects, which we then are going to do the biopsy in. In the whole sample, naturally, there were some who had still more reduction in muscle strength. And such a reduction in muscle strength have definitely an impact on the ADL activities, like rising from a chair or climbing stairs, and would in quite a number of these subjects mean a maximal force output repeated at different occasions during the day. The results from determination of the distribution of muscle fibers are shown on this slide with individual results. And you can identify two main groups. One group with a high number of type 1 fibers, between 70 and 100% in vastus lateralis, where there usually is around 50% type 1 fibers, and one group from 50% and below, and even down to around 10% type 1 fibers, for two different groups. And the opposite for type 2, he's separating type 2A and type 2B fibers, and in some subjects, naturally then, very few or hardly none or no type 2B fiber or type 2A fiber. And there were few type 2C, the indifferent fibers noted in these specimens. We were then interested by looking at relationship between function and morphology, and here's one example of that. We could find statistically significant relationship between different measurement of strength, here represented as isometric strength at 60 degree knee angle, and percentage of type 1 fibers, so that the people with the most reduced strength had the highest number of type 1 fibers. And the results were the same using isokinetic measured values, and the same in men and women. Correlation coefficient being in the order of between 0.5 up to 0.8. Now, this finding was actually noted in another simultaneous study, or a similar finding was noted in a simultaneous study in Stockholm, and just presented by the group up there using a muscle biopsy from the tibialis anterior. And one of the authors of that paper belonged to the family, but don't think it was a family plot. We didn't know of each other's studies when they were performed. We just think it's fine. We agree that there may be changes in fiber distribution due to activity pattern. We can pursue that question a little further. Fiber area were measured, and fiber areas were on average large in quite a number of the subjects. The mean fiber area for the whole group being high, and about or nearly 100% larger than expected from normal muscles, both for type 1 and for type 2 fibers. There were people with a rather normal fiber size and some with a very high sized fiber areas. So we had a number of subjects with many type 1 fibers and with large type 1 fibers, but also in some of these subjects large type 2 fibers. We looked for correlations, and correlations were found in men, not in women. I couldn't tell why, but they were found in men, between fiber size, here represented mean fiber area, and different measurements of muscle strength, here represented as muscle strength as isokinetic extension at the degree of 30 degrees per second, at the velocity of 30 degrees per second, which is a rather slow velocity. But the same was found also with recordings with a high angular velocity. In women, no significant correlation of this type was found. We could naturally speculate that women have another activity pattern, not giving this hypertrophy, or that there might be hormonal differences anyway, or that the material are just too small. So we had two types of adaptation here noted, which both were correlated to changes in strength or reduction in strength. Now to the histopathology. This is a biopsy stained with alkaline pre-incubation in one of the subjects with a high number of type 1 fibers, demonstrating type grouping of type 1 fibers. Another subject also with a high number of type 1 fibers, but here you can see quite a number of atrophic type 2 fibers with a stain of alkaline pre-incubation, and also some angulated small fibers, which was not a very common finding. So this is a fairly atypical biopsy for our group of patients. I repeat again, biopsies taken from subjects who could perform a full knee extension against gravity and had some symptoms of reduced weakness in that leg. And here at the end, biopsy from a subject with a high number of type 1 fibers, and you can see that they are about equal size and there was just a few atrophic fibers seen. To summarize the histopathological findings, fiber atrophy with groups more than 10 fibers were found in a few of the subjects, and concerning type 2 fibers in 4 of the subjects. Small angular fibers only also in few of the subjects. Small round fibers in nearly everybody. Large grouping also found in a high number. And if you lower it a little, because then you should see it, 19 subjects in 12 of the 19 subjects. And it was found both for type 1 and type 2 fibers. Internal nuclei, more than 3% was found in about half of the subjects. More than 10% just in one or two. Splitting in about half of the subjects, but not a very common splitting, just a few fibers. In fibrosis was a fairly uncommon finding. So this rather roughly is the same type of findings that earlier recorded here. And we can then naturally discuss how much of this is an effect of the innervation-reinnervation process, and how much of these so-called large grouping of type 1 fibers could be a change, as already described earlier this morning, from type 2 to type 1 fibers, and thus indicating another type of process. Our correlation between, or negative correlation between muscle function as measured as muscle strength and the percentage of type 1 fibers indicate such a change. We also looked for capillary density, capillary density as calculated per square millimeter was rather low in both men and women compared with what is found in clinically healthy elderly men and women. Calculated per fiber, it was not low, but taken into consideration the large fiber size, the fiber area calculated per capillary was normal or rather low. It varies between different subjects. We were maybe still more interested in a little easier type of analysis, namely of the enzymatic activity measured after homogenization. And here's some example of the findings. We measured citrate synthetase, 3-phosphate dehydrogenase, lactate dehydrogenase, and myokinase. And if we look first at citrate synthetase, we can find a large variation in values, both in men and women, with a low average value compared with what we found in a control material studied in our own laboratory with the same technique. I think it's important to have exactly the same technique, and therefore the only available group at the moment is a group of elderly men, all, so to speak, clinical healthy, who had considerably higher average value than this group of subjects. Whereas the average values for the other enzymes were within the same range as found in this so-called control group, but even here with a large individual variation. So it seems that especially the oxidative enzyme here is reduced in most of our subjects, where the other enzymatic activities are more or to a larger extent within normal range. We know all that the activity of an oxidative enzyme will adapt very fast, usually within a few weeks, to the activity pattern, and this could thus be effect of a general disuse of the muscles. And we'll discuss that further in the next paper. And to summarize, we found large grouping of type 1, type 2 fibers, some splitting, some internal nuclei. We found the fiber distribution in a number of subjects with large number of type 1 fibers, and they had lower muscle strength. We found in quite a number of subjects large fibers, both for type 1 and type 2, and in men, especially in those with low muscle strength, and there was a reduced oxidative enzymatic activity. Thank you.
We're going to take some questions at this point before the next paper.
Joeet from Philadelphia. I have one question. How long did you exercise these patients?
We are not speaking about training. We are speaking about testing.
Okay.
Now. The training will be described in the next paper.
Okay, basically you are evaluating the base values, I suppose. Is that right?
Here, yes, in this paper.
The next question refers to the capillary density. In your data, I don't see any kind of difference because distribution is quite large. And I would like to find out if there are any p-values you can attach to any of the data you have shown in those.
But capillary density, I didn't make any large point of that because there is such a large individual variation. And I didn't have the proper control material for that. I just wanted to mention that as an observation. And as you saw, I didn't make much point of that. It is low when with respect per square millimeter. That's the only definite conclusion.
And that's true for the oxidative enzymes as well. Is that right or not?
That's true. And they are expressed per gram protein. So they're expressed per gram muscle tissue. And then they are low.
What I'm wondering is, would you expect a kind of change in the oxidative capacity as well as capillary density per fiber if you are going to train the muscles with the strengthening type of activities?
You will get the answer in the next paper.
Okay, thank you.
Bradley, with regard to a question that's clearly going to be of increasing significance, can you compare your data with Marinos de Lacas's data with regard to large grouped atrophy and whether you were in fact looking at any patients who had progressive muscle weakness in the muscle which you were studying? I gather you didn't find any such large group atrophy, and was that because of a preselection bias, or do you have any evidence on that?
We found grouped atrophy defined as more than 10 atrophic fibers at the same time grouped together in 4 of these 19 subjects. Some of them had, as the majority of our subjects, reported symptoms over the last years, and one or two of them had not reported such symptoms. To summarize, about one-fourth of our subjects did not report any increasing symptoms. Three-fourths had reported it over the last years, and we could in no of our measurements find any significant substantial difference between these two subgroups. One reason may be that the group of subjects who did not report any symptoms was low, only 5 of the 19 subjects. But we can say that we find type grouping in large number of the subjects.
How did your quantitative strength measurements compared to your manual muscle tests, which I think you noted you had done?
We are treating those data. I haven't presented them here. As I said, we, in this specific sub-study, we only have subjects who could perform a full knee extension against gravity, which means they had more than three, usually than four or five. So for that subgroup, correlations cannot easily be made. For the total sample, we will work on that, but that needs naturally more muscle strength measurements of other muscles and in the total group of subjects.
Thank you, Dr. Perry.
Rostov, London. You showed an inverse correlation between strength and mean fiber area, and on your conclusion slide, you show that large fibers in men are correlated with low muscle strength, that inverse correlation. I'm quite ignorant of this. Does that suggest that because there are large fibers, there is hypertrophy because of loss of fibers, and that purely reflects a smaller number of muscle fibers? I'm asking for information. I.e., is there a trivial explanation for that?
A strength training program would lead to an increase in cross-sectional area of muscle fibers. These are the subjects with the lowest muscle strength. The hypothesis from the findings would then be these subjects have reduced a large number of motor units and also muscle fibers, and have to stress the remaining motor units and muscle fibers, so they hypertrophy, to be able to cope with the need of knee extension in daily life, like rising from a chair, climbing stairs, which they can do, but maybe using maximal voluntary force.
Dalakas, can you clarify the question Dr. Bradley asked before? Did you find group atrophy in muscles that have been previously affected and had partially recovered, or you did not find group atrophy? We're talking about atrophic fibers in groups, not just isolated, angulated fibers.
We found it in four of the 19 subjects, yes?
Which is surprising to see a muscle that has been affected and has only partially recovered not to have significant atrophic fibers. We found this in almost all the patients.
And you're amazed that we don't find it in more subjects? Is that what you are saying?
Right. With the residual atrophy. These are muscles who have residual atrophy from the original disease. Is that right?
I talk about group atrophy, and that's what you're talking about too.
Yeah.
And we have four subjects with that, and they have these muscle function, and that's all I can say. They report some increase in weakness over the last years.
Yeah, but the muscles that have been biopsied are muscles that have been left weak and atrophic from the original disease?
They have been weak from the original disease, yes. And then they might have an increasing weakness over the last years, but still not more than that I can do a full knee extension.
Okay.
No other questions. We'll go on to the next speaker, Dr. Anderson, who's, I guess, in two places, at Gothenburg and also Reykjavik, who's going to be talking on strength and exercise program in post-polio subjects.
Well, some people have been asking me if I've been studying polio in Iceland, and the answer is no. I just moved there 2 months ago, so all my patients are from the Gothenburg studies. But as you see, the polio subjects in Iceland, they don't have any troubles with air pollution, and by judging the growth in the country, we don't have any problems with pesticides either. In this study we had 12 patients which we trained, and they were taken from this group of 41 polio survivors that Dr. Grimby told you about earlier. After the meeting in Warm Springs 2 years ago, we felt that we would need to do a study of a strengthening exercise program and try to use some methods of reproducible measurements of strength. So out of these 19 persons that Dr. Grimby told you about and that were possible to train in the sense that we wanted to use the vastus lateralis muscle and train the quadriceps group of muscles, we got 12 subjects willing to volunteer for the training. And all those patients, they were of the ages 41 to 63 years, and they were the same study criteria for those, of course, as was for the bigger study of 41 survivors. The reason for not taking in older patients than 65 was to be sure of avoiding changes that might be dependent on age. I just want to remind you of the appearance of this of the bigger group of patients. They, in most respect, are very much alike other groups that we have heard about, with respect to time of recovery and time of best function and time of decreased function or deterioration of function. So that's the their times of in this respect. As Dr. Grimby mentioned earlier, we measured the muscle strength of the patients in a Cybex 2 dynamometer at the angular velocities of 30 to 300 degrees isokinetic force, and at the angles 30 and 60 degrees of the knee in isometric force. In order to try to measure the effect of training, we did muscle biopsies before and after the training, and we measured fiber distribution, fiber area, histopathology, and enzymatic analysis. And you've just seen the major results of this study, and those results were based on 13 patients, of which 12 were trained in this study. I also want to mention the relation of strength between polio subjects, and those are the 13 biopsied, while 12 of them were trained, and as you see, they are really very weak, even if the study criteria here was that they could make a fully resisted extension in the knee in order to fit the requirements for training the quadriceps strength. So by definition, the strength on the MRC scale would be 3 plus at least. The training program is a delicate thing in such subjects, which many of which are severely disabled. We had a standardized warming up program consisting of 5 minutes 5 minutes exercise on an exercise cycle at 30 watts, and all the patients were able to do that. And then the training program consisted of 12 sets of 8 isokinetic contractions, all at 180 degrees angular velocity.
This is the end of side one. Please turn the tape over now and continue listening on side two.